Good morning. We're in the middle of discussing the halachos of the heteriska, and today we're going to focus on some of the practical issues that come up and some, you know, some eitzes, how to deal with some common problematic situations. Now, as we explained over the past 2 weeks, the basis of a heteriska is there is no loan between the parties. It's a partnership, it's an investment. And it's an investment that carries a certain level of risk. If the borrower, again, we'll use borrower and lender as it's not really the correct language, but just for simplicity, we'll call them a borrower and lender. But if the borrower can bring witnesses that there was a loss, or if he's willing to make a shvua that there were no profits, he does not have to pay back the entire investment. Chatzim over chatzim pikadim means they share the profits and share the losses. And this risk is something that has to be in every iska. Some iskas try to avoid the risk by writing language to the effect that the parties are agreeing from day one that the borrower will not make a shvua, he will not bring edim. Instead, he will pay the agreed upon return. And by writing that, you're essentially making the iska puzzle. Because for the whole heter is based on the fact that it is continuously a partnership, and the borrower, the recipient, continuously has the option of bringing the edim, making the shvua, and not repaying the entire amount. Now, because an iska is based on a partnership, we mentioned last week that it's only appropriate if the borrower is actually investing the money. On the other hand, in contrast, if he's taking the money, he's paying off bills, he's doing something that will not generate income, the basis of heteriska simply does not make sense. What is the partnership? How is the lender demanding a share of the profits? There are no profits to be earned by paying your grocery bill. So it has to be that the money that's being taken is being invested in something that they anticipate to generate profits that will cover the interest payments, if you will. Now, if a person does want to borrow money b'iska to pay for personal use, if he has other investments, there's a very simple eitzah. And that is, just like if I own a piece of property, I can tell you, give me $100,000, and I'm going to give you a share of this property. What I do with this money is irrelevant. I can use it to pay my bills. But the deal is, in exchange for the money that you give me, I am selling you a share in my investments. So with an iska as well, you can make up that you're giving me $50,000, what I do with it is really none of your business. But in exchange for this money, I'm going to assign to you a share of my other investments. So as long as I do have some investment somewhere, it doesn't matter what I'm using these dollars for. The partnership is created once you pay the money to me, once you make a kingin, and that is perfectly fine. Now, another issue that we raised last week is that when you have two partners, and one of them, they need money for the business. One of them puts up the money and wants to do an iska with his shotif. Here, the Gris Moshe says we have a problem. Because they're both partners and they're both actively involved with the business, if the business does not do well, the lender has no right to demand repayment. Because normally with an iska, how does the lender protect himself from any losses? The lender tells the borrower, it's true we're partners, and it's true if you can prove there's a loss, I'm going to share that loss 50-50. But I want real proof. I don't trust you. I'm not going to take your word for it. You need witnesses. And if you don't have witnesses, you have to pay me back the entire principal. In a case where the borrower and lender are partners, they're both involved in the business, it doesn't make sense for the lender to tell the borrower, I want you to prove what happened. The lender is a partner. He's the one that sees the books. He knows just as well as his partner what happened. And therefore, if there's a loss, if there are no profits, he cannot demand repayment from his shutif. But still, you can't take it. Because you know there are no profits. You know you're not entitled to the money. And there's no basis. In a regular heteriska, the borrower, even if the borrower knows there are no profits, since he doesn't want to make a shvua, he can make the payment. Over here, there's no chiyuv shvua. I can't bring my partner to Beis Din and make a shvua on something that I know firsthand.
That's the same thing.
Excellent, excellent. So the way to deal with these situations is the eights that we just mentioned. What you do is, if you want to lend your partner money, even though this money is being pumped into the business, you write in the ISCA that in exchange for the money that you're putting into this business that we're partners in, we're creating an ISCA Schutzbis on the other investments that the partner owns. And that way, although we may be partners in this particular venture, since the lender does not know what's going on with the other investments belonging to his partner, his private investments, we now have an ISCA that the lender has no direct knowledge and has the right to demand either Edim, a Shvuah, or to make this payment in lieu.
So the investor does not need to have knowledge as to what the borrower is doing, which investment he's investing in. Let's just say a person has stocks and he has real estate. He does not have to disclose where he's becoming a partner.
No, and the lender is better protected the less he knows. What would happen is that if the borrower wants to claim there was a loss, he would go to Beis Din, he would show to Beis Din where Edim, Shvuah, however he'll establish where he invested the money, and then he'll have to establish what happened. But the less the lender knows about exactly where this investment went, the better off he is for this reason. Now, we had mentioned 2 weeks ago a story with a margin account. A Jewish company had a margin account. There was a heter iska. The borrower said, you can't ask me to pay because you're the one that sends me the statements, you know there's a loss. So this is the problem the Gris Moshe was dealing with. What they did subsequently is they changed all the heter iskas that even if the money is staying in a margin account, they wrote the iska is being created on other assets, other investments of the borrower, and that way the lender is better protected for these kind of situations. So Malva does not have an achrayus. If a borrower comes in and says, I want to borrow money by Iska, he does not have to interrogate him and find out whether or not he has assets. That being said, if he knows, if it's someone who you know doesn't have assets, he certainly cannot give it to him because an Iska does not make sense if there's no investment.
If it's a margin account, they know for a fact that it's only used.
Correct. But just like what the Iska says is like this. You're opening a margin account. We're going to give you a line of credit of $50,000 for you to trade stocks in this account. In exchange for this money, we're becoming your partner in your real estate investments. So it's true these dollars were frozen in this account, but in exchange for these dollars, this is not where the ISCA was. The ISCA was created on other assets of the borrower, and therefore the borrower or the bank has every right to say, we know you lost your shirt in the margin account. We have no idea what happened in your other investments. Either prove what happened or... So that's a good question. How do you prove where the investment went? So if there's a money trail, if I give you money and the ISCA's on what it was spent, then you show the money trail. In this case, there is no money trail because the money is in the margin account. That is true. What I've seen, I've seen some achrayim say that you're ne'eman b'shvuah which iska or which investment you assigned in exchange for this money. What I like writing into the heter iskas is that even though you write eidim b'shvuah, I like writing in that Beis Din can accept whatever verification is needed al pi halacha. And therefore, to prove which investment it is, you'll probably have to believe him with a shvuah or accept it. Once he establishes where he put it, then you'll need to aid him on the loss or a shvuah on the profits.
As the money is a fungible thing, it's not that you have to say it went here, went there. You have a certain amount.
So if you look carefully, there are two types of iskas, and it's done differently, really, to deal with this issue. Some iskas say that in exchange for the money that's going to the margin account, the borrower will assign a share in another investment that he has. Now, in that case, the borrower has an obligation. When you go into the bank, you open the brokerage account, you really have an obligation to sit there and make a cheshbon. Okay, Bank Leumi is now going to be a partner in this and this property. Reality, that doesn't happen. So what other ISCAs write to address this is it says specifically that in exchange for that money, you become a partner in all of his investments, a prorated share. Now, in that case, you would have to establish the Beis Din a list of your entire portfolio. And then, at the end of the year, we just have to figure out whether across the board, your entire portfolio went up, down, what the percentage is. But Enoch Rami, because people generally do not think about it and do not assign a specific investment, that's why lately there's been a shift to make it into all the assets, not a specific investment.
I mean, can an individual indeed say that, the investment, could the bank say, we don't accept, well, let's say he assigns a particular building. Can't they say, no, we're in all your assets.
It depends. In ISCA is a partnership. So it depends on the terms of the partnership. If the partnership says, and some ISCAs say, that the borrower will invest it in the investment that he thinks is the best investment that he thinks he has, so that's the borrower's discretion to figure out which one that is. Other ISCAs say that he's becoming a partner across the board in all of his assets. So if that's what it says, he's by definition, by accepting the money, he's made the bank into a partner in everything. So it really depends on the ISCA.
Home ownership is enough.
Home ownership, yes. There is a discussion among the earlier Achroinim that some rejected it. Today, I believe everyone assumes it is enough because home ownership, until recently, was a very good investment. And there's both. You have to realize there's both the capital gains, there's also the rental value of the house. Because to the extent that the bank owns it, they have the right to charge you rent for living there. So it is something which is fine. Now, because an ISCA is an investment, the return that the lender is receiving is based on his share of the profits. So number one, the borrower has to have investments that are generating profits. If you're giving it to a younger man who has no investments, so there's really no pshat in an ISCA. Also, you're not going to get your money back. But again, and we mentioned last week a Shaul Meshiv, but we're not going to go through that again. But the other point is that the return that you're earning on a Heter Iska has to also be in line with anticipated profits. On a Chatzim Ova Chatzim Pikadoin, because you're only responsible for half the losses and you're only entitled to half the profits, so if you want to charge 10% on an Iska, you have to be giving it for an investment that is anticipated to make at least 20%. Because again, you're only chatzi milvo chatzi pikadon, so you have to make sure if you're a hard money lender and you're charging them 16-18%, that you have to be. It has to be for a venture or for a business that can be reasonably expected to earn double that. Okay, that's a good question. Some people do a kuli pikadon. Now, kuli pikadon means that instead of it being a partnership 50-50, it means that the money, the investment, is totally owned by the lender. He is responsible for all of the losses, and he gets all of the profits minus what he pays the manager for managing the investment. Now, doing it that way exposes the lender to twice the risk as a chatzim over chatzim pikadon. Because if you can prove that the money is all gone, you get nothing back, as opposed to the classic a Heter Iska, where only half of it is at risk. But in a case where you're asking for a rate of return, which is again, let's assume the property, this investment is expected to earn 10%, and you want 7%, a Chatzimova will not work, because Chatzimova you cannot ask for more than a 5% return. In those cases, people do write a Kuli Pikadon. The other preference for a Chatzimova is, since it is the more traditional way, and it's based on an investment that is discussed in the Gemara. The Gemara says a classic iska, not heter iska, classic iska is chatzim over chatzim pikadon. So we try to model this as much, to make it as similar to a typical investment as possible. In the reality today, the much more money is given as a kuli pikadon out there than as something like a chatzim over chatzim pikadon. Every time you give money in a mutual fund or a hedge fund, it's essentially a kuli pikadon. The lender, the investor, has all the risk and all of the profits, minus less whatever he's paying for a management fee. So it is a common investment. If you know, you could write a kuli pikadon whenever if the rate is too high. It certainly is done.
And it's good to have to only
pay him $1
for his services.
A kuli pikadon is not entirely clear. You have to pay him for his services because it's a chatzimah, because there's no loan over there. And adrabah, the management fee usually is the fact that he's keeping anything above a certain rate. Apple Pekin, there is a dollar for Schar Tircha. It's there to make him to a Shemer Sachar. It's also because In the beginning of Kuf Ayin Vav, when you have an investment and they're splitting the responsibilities, you do run into iska problems. Your question was because the Gvilta, because he's not managing it for himself? Right, but even by Kula B'Kadin, he usually has his own money. You know, he is playing with his own money as well. So that's why, although it's not Chatzim of Chatzim B'Kadin, it's almost unheard of for him to be playing with only your money in a Kula B'Kadin. So it's not relevant for that reason as well.
I don't think most of these hedgers who come into this scenario where somebody is wants all into money for 12% turn, and that's it. And you know, the guy who's borrower knows that they'll probably make 18-20%. So,
well, if the borrower only expects to make 20% on his money, then he cannot write a regular ISKA at 12%. In that case, you have to write a Kula B'Kadin. In a Kula B'Kadin, you can pay up to 20% or a little bit less than that. But if you're not expecting to earn double the rate of return, I'm not talking about dollars, I'm talking about rate of return, you know, the return on the investment, then it should be a Kula B'Kadin, not a Chatzim Ovah Chatzim
B'Kadin. What you expect, and what you actually did, if you're going to say it's supposed to.
Well, no, because the point over here is it's a partnership where I'm giving you an escape, where instead of making the Shavua, I'll accept this payment in lieu. This payment, it only makes sense if this payment is a reasonable estimate of what the investor's share of the profits ought to be. And then he's saying, okay, either pay this or prove exactly what the actual outcome was.
So I just think there's
another,
it could be 24% return. That's
enough. It depends on if this is what's reason, it makes sense to sell for someone to anticipate this and this to be the value to buy out his share, that is shvur, then you can do it. But if it's not a number that makes sense, then do a Kula B'Kadin.
Is it really expected? The way they make projections on investment usually is they have a base case scenario and they have an optimistic scenario and they have a pessimistic scenario. So if you really need that,
optimistic is fine. Because you always have the option of making a shvur or bringing Aiden that this did not happen. So there's nothing wrong with saying, if you want me to waive the shvua and just accept this, I'll take the best case scenario and then walk away. But if it's something which just doesn't make any sense, then there's no explanation for an ISKA.
So it's more than your normal range of expectations.
That's fine. That's fine.
Okay.
That's fine. If you want to get technical, it can really be above that, because normally when you're making these calculations, you're factoring in the fact that you're putting work in, you're getting a salary. Over here, the manager is getting paid a dollar for his work. So that differential can be added, which, if it's a small investment, can make a huge difference in the expected rate of return.
So the bottom point is that Kula B'Kadin theoretically should always work. The only reason why we don't do it is because it doesn't follow the case of the Gemara.
It could always work. You can get double the rate. You can get the same rate of return as the recipient is expecting to earn. On the other hand, it does expose you to twice the risk. But if you're fine with that in economy, and some people prefer doing this because there's no real loan, others prefer not because it's not traditional and because it's not modeled after the investment of the Gemara. Now, there are some achroinim that say that when you're doing an ISKA, you should not be charging more than the normal bank rate. They say if you do that, it's nicker that it's a harama. It's a shtickle tzarechi, and I don't know why it should be a harama. If anything, I think charging the bank rate is a harama, because then you're showing it's really a loan. If you're asking for more, it indicates more, it's really a partnership where you're taking a share in the profits. So I don't know exactly what the issue is. Now, regardless, in general, when loan sharks come to me with help writing a heter iska, I generally decline. Not because there's a problem of ribis. If the borrower has a lucrative investment, then and that can justify this return, as far as Hilchos Ribbis, it's fine. But I have better things to do with my time than helping loan sharks. But in Hilchos Ribbis, as long as the rate is, or standard ISKA is less than half of what he expects to earn, it's fine regardless of how high it is or how short-term the loan is. Now, interestingly enough, there is considerable amount of litigation in the United States over exactly how the courts view a heter iska. We'll talk about it more next week, but typically the courts have thrown out heter iskas and basically said it's a loan, it looks like a loan, it acts like a loan, it sounds like a loan. They treat it as a loan. It's the interest is tax deductible. They ignore the halacha. But one of the very few cases where they actually upheld the heter iska was, it seems, I think this is in the late 1800s, someone lent money with an iska, and it was a loan shark. He charged him a very high interest rate, and the litigation was whether this violated the usury laws. There are limits. You can't charge, in the United States, you can't charge above a certain rate. The lender defended himself by saying, usury applies to a loan. A partnership, an investment, has no such restrictions. Pulls out the heter iska and says, this is a shutfist. This is a joint venture, and it should not be subject to the usury laws. And believe it or not, the judge fell for it, and the lender got away with it. It was the rule that it was a partnership, not a loan, and the typical usury laws did not apply. That being said, in typical cases, to speak to the attorneys about that. But
that's the Jewish law.
And if you're taking advantage, if you're going ahead, someone's desperate. You know, we mentioned the Zohar, the Chavetz Chaim brings down from the Zohar that the seventh mandura of Gehenna is reserved for someone who an ani comes to him and he won't give him money without being nana from him, without taking advantage of him. That being said, you have a case where someone has an opportunity, and by you providing the capital, you're enabling him to take advantage of that opportunity. It depends on the case, but it's not going to be in your day. It's not going to be a ribbis shaila or a chayish mishpat shaila. It'll be a yashis shaila. It'll be what's erlich, and that's something which you'll have to take on a case by case scenario. Now, typically, when a person writes a heter iska, so in the olden days where a heter iska was essentially done between two friends, two people who knew each other, a simple document. So we have the standard pre-printed form. He's borrowing $10,000. He's giving back $11,000. It's pretty straightforward. Today, very often, many of the deals that come up are more sophisticated transactions. People go to attorneys. They get long documents drafted with all sorts of contingencies, default clauses, and very often, if you miss a payment or if you don't pay by at a certain rate, at a certain time, the rate suddenly jumps. How can this be done with a heter iska? So, in theory, there's really a simple way to do it, and that is, as we explained, the heter iska is a partnership. The investor is really entitled to half the profits. There's an agreement that if the borrower pays the principal plus 8%. Then he no longer has to make a shvua, and he can keep all the extra profits. There's nothing wrong with an investor saying that, listen, if you pay me back by this date, then I'll accept the principal plus 8%, and anything else you keep, no shvua, no edom. If you pay me back after this date, or if you don't follow this list of terms and conditions, at that point I'm only willing to waive my shvua if I get back the principal and 12%. So you can create a default rate. It's a default rate. It's simply that the cost or the right that you have to buy out the shvua is subject to payments being done within this time frame. If it's past that, then if you want to buy out the shvua, the price goes up.
Does that also have to be a realizable return?
Yes. It still has to make sense. Now the problem is that although this certainly could be done, many of the pre-printed forms that people use, they just download a standard heter iska form, which just says they're borrowing X amount of dollars and this is the rate of return, and they sign it. They then go ahead and they sign these 200-page legal documents that have all sorts of terms and conditions. In such a case, where they have a heter iska, and the heter iska just has a flat number or a flat percentage, even if there's a default, even if you don't pay on time, al pi halacha, you have absolutely no right to demand anything more than what it says in the iska. Now, it's very easy to address this problem, and many of the newer heter iskas written, instead of having a flat amount that you have to pay to buy out the shvua, it basically says if you comply with all of the terms and conditions in the attached loan agreement, and that way, it's basically by incorporating by reference all the terms and conditions of the loan document. But if you don't have that, if you used a standard heter iska that says, I'm borrowing X amount of dollars, and if I pay you this flat rate, I don't have to make a shvua, then you can take all the other terms and contingencies in the loan document and throw it in the garbage, and you would have no right, al pi halacha, to collect any of those type of fees or default rates because it's not in the iska. And the iska is the document that you have to follow if you want to avoid any problems of Ilchus Rebus.
How can you sign up that
secular? Very good. So that's the next question that we're going to address. Does a heter iska have to be in writing? And how do we deal with situations where on one hand there's a heter iska that says that it's a partnership, on the other hand there's a loan agreement that flat out contradicts the heter iska and says there's no risk, there's no partnership, and it's a halva. So the Gemara that we learned this morning discusses a case where you roll the interest with the principal. And the Gemara says we have a problem. Even if verbally you agree that this is an iska, if you write a document which gives the lender the opportunity to collect the principal and the interest, or the Rambam adds and the Mechaber adds, if you write any shtar choiv on this money, we have a problem. Now the Gemara explains what's the problem. The problem is, although verbally the parties understood it was an iska, and although the lender is a frum a yid, and if anything happens, if the borrower is ready to make a shvur or bring edim, he's not gonna demand payment. But the Gemara says maybe the lender will die, and his yisayimim, his orphans, will see the document. They won't know the history, and they'll demand repayment. And when the borrower says it wasn't really a loan, it was really an iska, and I'm ready to bring edim, they'll say, "Listen, we don't know what you're talking about. We see a loan document. Pay up." So therefore, the Gemara says that this situation is also. Now, based on this, the Mechaber writes the halacha that if you're going to lend someone money, if you're going to write a loan document, even though verbally there was an agreement for it to be a heter iska, it's going to be it's possible, and you cannot demand, you cannot force him to pay the interest. The Shach over there writes that this is only true when there's a loan document, and the iska is completely verbal. That means you have no evidence that it's really an iska. However, if you have edim that were there that can testify that it's really an iska, then we're not worried about the loan document. Because if the lender tries to collect with a loan document, you can always pull out the witnesses and you'll be able to defend yourself, you'll be able to stop yourself from, you'll be able to prevent the lender from collecting the interest. So there are two cases. The case over there is where not loan, it's an iska of 1100. So there, even though it says iska, the principal amount included the anticipated interest, that's one problem. The second problem in Shulchan Aruch is when you only write the 1000, but you write it as a loan and not as an iska. Two separate problems. Again, there might be differences in halacha and b'di'evid, but those are the issue is you're giving the lender an opportunity to collect money that he may not be entitled to.
The assignment
won't believe you. The assignment will say, "We see the document; it says 1100. You want to say it was really 1000, and they rolled in the interest. You have no proof to that, and therefore, until you have edim for a loss, you have to pay the full 1100."
That's only in the first case.
In the second case, it's even worse. Second case, there could be a loss. You can claim it's an iska, but the assignment will say, "We see an IOU You see a promissory note. You claim it's an iska." We don't have any evidence to that, and therefore you can bring all the aid in the world, there was a loss, we're going to foreclose on this note. So the Shach says that if you have aid in that it was an iska, even though the shtar says that it's a loan, that would be fine. Now what happens when you have two documents that contradict each other? You have a shtar choiv, and at the same time you sign a heter iska. So really, al pi din, as long as the heter iska overrides the shtar choiv, this is the equivalent of having edim. Because just like in the case of edim, you have a shtar choiv, but if the person tries to collect with a shtar choiv, you'll bring the witnesses that it's really an iska, and you won't have to pay. So here as well, if he ever comes with a shtar choiv, the promissory note, you'll pull out the heter iska, and you won't be able to collect. Now, where you have to be careful is that today's contracts are usually have an integration clause, and they usually very specifically override any other agreements signed between the parties. Now, if you do that, if you write a heter iska and then you sign a promissory note which says it overrides any other documents, you now have a problem. Because now you've signed that the ikker, it's really a loan, it's not an iska. So you either have to make sure to sign the iska after the promissory note, Or you can reference in the promissory note that it's subject to the heteriska, or alternatively, you can write in the heteriska specifically that it overrides the promissory note. But in that case, it's clear, although you have two contradictory documents, it's clear the iska is the ikker, and we're not afraid that the person will collect it.
For that 1 second, when you wrote the promissory note, you already didn't miss it.
No, because the iser of tzitzas ribis is only when you got the money. If you write the note, and then the promissory note, and then before you receive the money, you write the heteriska, there was never tzitzas ribis. Besides which, you usually write the document, you give it to the lawyer, it usually gets given over at the same time. So until it's given to the other party, there's no tzitza. It's true. So you should be writing in the promissory note that it's subject to the iska, or alternatively, you should be writing the iska that it overrides the promissory note. And once you do that, then it's clear.
Why don't you just next make it one document or next?
Very good. So the question really is that why, if it's an iska, why in the world are you writing a loan document? So of course, the easy reason is we want to give some parnassah to the attorneys. But the answer is, and this is really, if you look, this is right from the time of Chassam Sofer, the answer is really like this. Al Pidin, you're right. Al Pidin, you should be writing an iska because that's what it is. It's a partnership. There's no loan. The problem is that if you only write, let's say you only write an iska, and the person doesn't pay. So you're then going to have to go bring him to Beis Din. He won't come to Beis Din. So you're then going to have to go to a judge, pull out a heter iska in Hebrew, start lecturing the judge about a chatimo v'chati pikadon, about a shutvis, an edus, and a shvua, and explain to him how now he owes you the money since he didn't make a shvua. You're not going to get very far. There's probably no way a judge has the right to make any determination whether it is a good shvua or not a good shvua. It's probably the establishment clause. It's going to be a mess. So in order to protect yourself, then in case he doesn't come to Beis Din or doesn't listen to Beis Din, you have recourse, you'll be able to collect the money in civil court, you need a promissory note. The Chassam Sofer in Chayshim Mishpat Simin Memches has a tshuva, where he wrote that when he used to lend out, he's actually telling Moses Yisayman, which I grabbed the more, there were different coolers there, but he says when he used to lend money of Yisayman, he used to write a promissory note, a legal promissory note, and he says he doesn't want to write the terms of the iska because then the courts aren't going to enforce it. So he wrote on the bottom, Ayin Pei, Hey Ayin. The abbreviations of Al-Pi Heter Iska. And that way, if it comes to Beis Din, it's very clear that it's an iska, they know not to call it, it's not a chayv. But if the need arises to enforce it in court, they'll be protected. So that's why people write promissory notes. It is a good idea, because that way they're protected. Just make sure that somewhere, at least in the heter iska, it's clear that it overrides the promissory note.
How do you really look at enforcing the negotiation court? They don't recognize that.
Very good, very good. So the Minchas Yitzchok that we have in the Maror Mekoyimus today says, you can only do this when the lender is from. He has a cheskes kashrus. If there's an issue that comes up and the borrower says, I'm ready to go to Beis Din, so he would never go to Arkoyis, he'll go to Beis Din. You need it in case the person simply doesn't pay and you're forced to foreclose, you now will be able to use the court system. But, Zok the Minchas Yitzchok, if the lender is not from, if he lost his cheskes kashrus, you cannot give him a document that will enable him to foreclose in civil court and ignore the heteriska. So the Chassam Sofer would never have done this if he was dealing with the lender who wasn't firm. Now in this case, the Gabbai Tztaka was the lender. He was a Tzayiz Din, and that wasn't the issue. But when you're dealing with a not firm company, and they want to set it up where the heteriska will not be legally enforceable, Minchas Yitzchok says you cannot be samech on that heteriska. That's true. That's assuming you get through the door in the Beis Din. But in case the person, because the person refuses to come to Beis Din, at that point you have to. You'll also need it because it's very nice to have a psak din. But if you do not have a mortgage note, then you're going to be last in line. So if you want to protect yourself from it being transferred, other people putting liens on, the way to protect yourself is to have a legal mortgage note which is recorded and done correctly. So just for protection, it's an appropriate thing to do, but it has to be understood it is subject to the terms of the heter iska. Now, a similar point that comes up, very often people with iskas ask for head checks, or they ask for security. So again, that's mutter, but it's only permitted if it's clear and it's understood these head checks, the security, are to secure the obligations of the iska. If the borrower is ever able, it comes to Beis Din brings aid in that there was a loss or makes a shvur, there are no profits, you can't cash the head checks and you have to release the security. So it's something that should be clear. It should be clear in writing. So if you want the protection, you can ask for it, but it has to be very clear. It is subject to the obligations of the heter iska. It sounds like he just relied on the alpi heter iska. And we'll get to in a moment. We'll get back to that in a moment.
Is that realistic in the heat of the moment when the guy's trying to collect his loan and then he's about to get the thing executed by court? The guy is saying, pull out the head disc, and the guy knows all the stuff going to melt
It's not a question of melting. When he goes into it before the fact, he has to know there's a risk. The heteriska has to write very clearly that it overrides the loan document. And if you think the lender is something, people have a cheskes kashrus. People have a cheskes kashrus. You know, being Jewish is very expensive. You pay tuitions, there are a lot of expenses, and this is one of them. And if you do not trust the lender, if he is someone who's not from, and you do not think he'll honor it at the end of the day, then you shouldn't be doing an iska with him.
At the end of the day, with this arrangement, you do have to have the documents in 1 second, only one heter iska. The bezdin is going to honor the heter iska, and the court is going to...
Correct. So if you have any doubt where the litigation will take place, you have a problem. But if from Yid has a cheskes kashrus that he will go to bezdin, and that's why, and he does not want to collect interest, and that's why he can be samech on it.
The
promissory note is the other way around. If the borrower is a loitzayas din, who refuses to come to Basel and just refuses to pay, you now have a way to collect. And you have a way to protect yourself from him transferring it or putting other liens on. It protects the lender that if the borrower is a loitzayas din. But if the borrower thinks the lender is a loitzayas din, then this iska is not worth very much. Correct. A non-from lender, I don't see any heter if it's not legally enforceable, which it typically is not. A non-from borrower is much easier, because a non-from borrower, if you think about it, the heter iska is always for his benefit. He never loses. So the only risk is, if he's not from, maybe he'll just roll into bezdin with a sefer Torah. What does he care about making a shvur sheker? But you may have a larger risk. Again, yesh lo doin whether bezdin will accept that shvur. But in a chanami. But as far as Isser v'heter, it is much easier. He may never do it, but one of the things that's done, and we do it all the time, is we explain to them the basic terms of the heter iska, and there's this, that if they meet these following, you know, rules of evidence, they can default. Now, it's clear in the Chassam Sofer that no one intended to do it. And he's still not to it, because it is a partnership where they have the right to do it. So it's not a question of the intent, it's a question of the ability and the right, and that's something which they have to have. So that we'll get to next week if we have time. That's an issue. Bezin has to make it possible. They either have to allow him to make a shvua either in front of Bezin, or they can say be covetous of Nishba somewhere else, or they have to accept other evidence. But they can't make it impossible, because then they can't write an iska in the first place.
One of the points is really bad with the exception of this rule, because they're not from lender, the way you explained last week, that this is the scale of the reputation.
Okay, that's a minchasizuk is okay, I'm not sure. Let's put that aside. How afraid they are, or how fear will play itself in is a separate issue. No. If he's not from, he's telling you in advance that I'm not going to listen to the iska. So if you can make it legally enforceable, that's fine. What happens also sometimes, you know, it's a problem. Sometimes there are workarounds. Maybe I'll give a non-recourse loan if you're something on the Gros Moshe. But if they want a regular loan with personal guarantee and they're only willing to write an iska that is not enforceable, I don't have any etza for you. If they don't have the cheses kashers and it's not enforceable, then correct. If it's done in a way where it is enforceable, or if you believe they have the cheses kashers, then you're fine.
So to deposit in this Israeli bank is pretty okay, but to borrow them is a problem.
To borrow, you have the Igros Moshe and the fact that you'll accept their shvuah. So you have two reasons why it's more common. Igros Moshe, because they're not personally liable. You have the corporation heter. But when you're borrowing from them, if they're not going to honor the heter iska, it's not legally enforceable, they're not from, you have a problem. If you can make it legally enforceable, then that's fine. Now, how to do that is beyond me. Could be. It hasn't been done yet. But I'm sure there's a way. I'm sure you can write an arbitration dispute. If you write a dispute resolution clause that goes to Bezdin, it will probably be enforceable that way. So if they're willing to sign a document, if there's any issue, it goes to Beis Din, you're probably okay. Because courts like enforcing that, and once it's in Beis Din, you're... Speak to the attorneys. If you can do it, you can do it. If not, not. It can't... People do. They're saying on the fact that, you know, as he said, that at the end of the day, the banks will honor it there, because otherwise everyone will stop paying their mortgages. So I think that's what they rely on at the end of the day. Now, when you have two contradictory documents, one thing which is becoming more common lately is very often you'll have, you know, with mortgage brokers or banks, they're willing to sign a heteriska, but their lawyers don't want heteriskas floating around. So they'll tell you, we'll sign the heteriska for you, but we're going to keep the only copy. So what's the halacha? Now, people are laughing. The truth is, it's not so simple. Because the Gemara has a case where a person wrote a shtar chayv, but he said verbally, don't worry, if there's any issue, I'm going to trust you. The Gemara says it's not acceptable. Why? Because maybe the lender will die, the assignment will get it, and they won't know better. They'll think it's a loan, and they'll foreclose. It's mashma that if we know the lender's not going to die, sounds like we can trust him. And some are medayik from this Gemara, that as long as the lender has a chesus kashrus, we're not afraid that he's going to come and lie to Beis Din and deny the iska. It's only maybe he'll die. You can't really control that. The assignment won't know that it's an iska. They'll collect it. But in a case where that's not a chashash, it's mutter. If that's the pshat, so then if you have a shtar choyd and a shtar iska, so what are you afraid about? The lender will die while he's alive. He's eruch yiri, has a chesus kashrus. He won't foreclose. What's the issue? Maybe he'll die. The assignment will see the note and they'll foreclose. The assignment, the same way they go when they're going through his files and they see the note, they'll see the iska. So some places can say it's fine. Others learn this Gemara's lav dafka. They say the same. The Gemara was talking about ameimar. No one was chayshish was going to go ahead and be goy the ribis, but for another malva, we're afraid. And to give him a document where he has the ability to collect, and the borrower has no evidence there was ever an iska, some place can machmer, and they say you can't do this. Now lemaisa, I know some of the mortgage brokers are samech lahakol. They have a psak that you can be samech on the mekilim. And there are brokers that will not give you a copy of the iska. What actually happened in Lakewood, it was interesting, is the Rabbanim were not happy with this. They were not happy, first of all, because of the machlokes. And second of all, the idea they don't want to give an iska, they sort of got the feeling maybe there's a reason why they don't want to give out the iskas. It's perhaps they don't plan on honoring it. So what the arrangement they did was, is that they agreed that whenever the broker wrote an iska, it was given biyad shlish. The broker gave it. There was an escrow agent, if you will. There was a rav who was in charge of these iskas, and he has a copy of every iska that goes through this bank or this broker. So this way, if the bank would ever try to foreclose shaloi kedin, where the borrower is ready to make a shvuah, ready to go to Beis Din, so a third party has the iska and will release it to the Beis Din. In the absence of that, if the borrower is not ready to make a shvuah, he's not ready to go to Beis Din, he just wants to use the iska to dray out of things or to gum up the foreclosure and just to add on some legal fees for the lender, but he's not ready to make a shvuah, ready to make edim, so there he does not have access to the document, and that way both parties are pretty much protected.
How does this work in real life? The broker buys the loan, sends it, sells it.
Very good, very good. So when you sell a loan, that opens up another host of issues. Because are you selling an ISCA or are you selling a loan? If you're selling an ISCA, it's probably bank fraud because Fannie Mae is not buying ISCAs, they're buying loans. And if you're selling a loan, we have a ribbis problem because that's a good question. That will deal with Meretz Hashem next year. Yeah, because the issue is, what are you selling? You're selling an ISCA, you're selling a loan. That's, again, it's an issue. The next year, next week there's no shear, but the week after, during our Seder Shmei, there will be a shear, and we're going to be focusing primarily on mortgage brokers, banks, these type of issues. But anyway, so just to finish up with this point, so as far as releasing the heteriska, some companies just don't release it, others do give it the yad shlish, and that way there's protection if needed, the borrower can have access to it, but the lenders don't have to worry about these documents floating around, and that was an acceptable compromise. And I actually dealt with one situation where the borrower the lender refused to release the heteriska. and he refused to show it to anybody. So I was dealing with an investor who was participating in the loan. The investor had no information. He didn't know who the borrowers were. He didn't have anything. And the lender really was being tough and refused to give over any information. So at the end, worked out an interesting compromise. It turned out that the lawyer that held all the documents for the lender was a frum yid. So we made up that he doesn't want to release it. He doesn't want to give it to anybody else. I'll go down to the lawyer's office, and I'll go through all the documents, and I'll check the heteriska. So I went down there, and I'm staying there with the frum lawyer. So now, at this point, we have two edim on every heteriska. We have the frum lawyer, and we have myself reading through it. So now, if there's ever any issue, we now have two edim that there is an iska. And there, the shach that we just learned says that edus is enough, since in the event there's any issue, you always have a way to prove that it was up the iska. Okay, next week in Mirat Hashem, there's no shir. It's Erev Hashanah. We wish everyone a ksiva chasima toiva. And Mirat Hashem, the week after, will be the final shir on heteriska, which we'll talk about banks and heteriska klali and other legal issues with the heteriska.
Very, 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 very Hashem, I did. I had hundreds of letters. And somebody was going to sue him and take away the house. They were going to sue me. So Baruch Hashem, I did it. I was